Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Series 9 of Monkey Tennis. As you may know, since 2016, we've been tirelessly dissecting, discussing, researching and celebrating the work of Alan Gordon Partridge, and we're fast approaching the milestone of 100 episodes. If you've been enjoying the pod, we've set up a Ko-fi page where you can show your appreciation and buy me, or us, a coffee. All you need to do is go to ko-fi.com/monkeytennis. So that's ko-fi.com/monkeytennis. If you've enjoyed listening and you'd like to show your appreciation, please consider buying us a coffee, Kenko or Flavia. It'll help us to continue to rake through Alan's past and future output. Nothing changes with the podcast. It's simply a way for you to show your support for the cream of our discharge. So thank you, and very thank you. Now, on with Series 9 of Monkey Tennis.
Aha!
Damn! Monkey tennis?
In no way, you big spastic, you're a mentalist! Damn!
That was just a noise.
Monkey tennis?
I got really drunk last night. Sick everywhere.
Monkey tennis?
Minor criticism, more distance between the eggs and the beans.
Monkey tennis?
I wish things had turned out differently, but I'm glad they didn't.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
You're a fucking...
Basically, beef tea.
Yeah.
Are you on an E?
Monkey tennis?
Back of the net.
Hello once again, and welcome to Monkey Tennis. Now, Alan Partridge and podcasting don't necessarily go together in the mind's eye, but 80-plus episodes later, and with Alan now doing his own podcast too, we think they do, in the brain's ear. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
I was touched deeply by an English teacher at school.
Nick Holder.
You should ask people if they want ice.
Tom Stab.
I love wordplay.
So, this week we're going to take a little look at open books. We've had a few of you in touch pledging your support for this little corner of the APU. It's obviously a special that went out to publicise the book I, Partridge, and it's a kind of a strange little curio in the Alan canon. So we're going to take a look at it this week before we move on to the bulk of Know Me, Knowing You, the radio show. Tom Dark is going to tell us a little bit about where it sits in the Partridge canon.
Thanks, Adam. Yes, I'm going to guide you through the timeline here. So this initially broadcast 2nd of July 2012 on Sky Atlantic. So we're in Gibbon's phase one here, as I like to call it. So to contextualise, this comes after Mid-Morning Matters, and the I, Partridge hardback edition was released 29th of September 2011, the paperback 26th of April 2012, and then that leads into Places of My Life and Open Books. Places of My Life aired on the 25th of June, Open Books a week later, no, 2 weeks later, 2nd of July. So clearly promoting the paperback release of I, Partridge, and also starting the TV broadcast promotion for Mid-Morning Matters Series 1, because that actually aired on Sky as half-hour episodes in 2012. And obviously, 2013, we had the Alpha Papa movie. So that's where we are in the APU. That's where we are in Gibbons Phase 1. And Tom, if I could throw over to you now, I believe we have the press release that went out when this show initially aired.
Broadcaster, author, and keen rambler Alan Partridge makes a welcome return to television screens as a special replacement guest on Open Books with Martin Bryce, hosted by Chris Beale. After the modest success of his previous book, Bouncing Back, it was pulped due to poor sales, Alan returns to discuss his latest tell-all tome, I, Partridge, We Need to Talk About Alan, a book critics have hailed as very thorough. In fact, Alan himself describes his autobiography as the best book he's ever written and one of the best he's ever read. High praise indeed from a man who started reading aged a half. The book charts Alan's rise from humble beginnings in a semi-detached house in a modest suburb of Norwich to TV superstardom before ultimately establishing himself as one of the better DJs on local radio station North Norfolk Digital. An accomplished chatter, Alan is only too keen to share the secrets of his craft, revealing details of his grueling writing regime, 1,500 words per day, usually with a bowl of hard-boiled eggs for sustenance, as well as his views on reading, writing, and literature in general. A truly absorbing interview that offers a rare insight into the mind of a man who clearly has had and continues to have the last laugh.
Beautifully read, Tom. That was great.
So, right from the opening credits, you've got a sort of an idea of how literary programming works in the APU. Author names flying across the screen, such as George Orwell, followed by Ian McEwan, and winding up with James Corden.
Yeah, you've got Orwell, Dickens, Rushdie, Corden, all the greats.
Yeah, and James Corden's autobiography is the only book by James Corden that I could find on Amazon, released in 2012, called May I Have Your Attention, Please? Ladies and gentlemen of Monkey Tennis listenership, can I have your attention, please, as I read one of the Amazon one-star reviews from this autobiography? Yes. I have to admit, I didn't buy this book. It was left on a train and I had nothing to read and a 2.5-hour journey, so I thought, what the heck, and cracked on. I would have been better served counting pylons pass. The writing is second rate, the anecdotes are uninteresting, and he fails to tickle my funny bone even once. I would rather slit open my scrotum, insert 15 live wasps, and stitch my scrotum back together, then ask Ian Botham to set about both my knees with a cricket bat while I sit back and downed a pint of caustic soda. Suffice to say, I don't recommend this book to anyone, much less actually spend any of your hard money on it. Naturally, I left it on the train when I alighted. I'll never get those 2 hours back.
Wow.
Scathing stuff.
I mean, as reviews go, saying that you'd rather split open your own scrotum, stuff it full of wasps, and then sew it back up again, it's not a ringing endorsement, is it?
Not really.
I think the worrying thing was, I also looked on his Amazon page, and sadly, there were lots of five-star reviews.
Oh, never read those.
No, there's nothing interesting there.
I just hate the general public.
people.
Can we talk a little bit about the conceit of this show? I think we're led to believe that it's a regular Norfolk based show. So is it supposed to be one of those ones that's kind of just put out locally on terrestrial telly? It's not a Pear Tree production, is it? It's not one of his own shows.
No, it's very clearly, Adam, it's Norfolk's foremost forum for lovers of literature. What more could you need to know?
Also, for those of us that didn't get the joke and might be slightly thick, it's supposed to be with Martin Bryce. It's hosted by Chris Beale. What's the joke?
Martin Bryce will never be seen.
Yeah, what am I missing? Is the idea that basically this is a show where the guest is a stand-in and so is the presenter? It's just replacement central. Or is there more to it?
Pretty much.
I think that's it. I would just question. I didn't think that was particularly funny.
But I think the joke lies in going Open Books with Martin Bryce with Chris Beale. It's kind of that weird, right. The extension of the
See. Yeah.
And then also the amount of times that he Alan says Martin and goes, it's Chris.
And we know from the press release that you just read that Alan wasn't the first choice for guest either. So it's understudies left, right and centre.
It's an absolute shambles of a show. So very much local television is happening.
It's local cable access. It's Wayne's World.
Shall we talk about Chris Beale?
Yes, I think we probably should.
Played by Robert Popper, who, of course, is the writer and creator of Look Around You and Friday Night Dinner.
Yeah, but this has just blown Nick's mind. So, before we dive into Robert Popper more, so, Nick, you're a huge fan of Friday Night Dinner, it's fair to say.
I really, really, really like it.
Haven't you met Robert Popper?
No, he's... No, no, he sent me a video message once.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So you, of his face. Hang on, so his face was in that video.
It was a personal and, message too. Yeah.
So then off mic, before we started recording this episode, weren't you just telling us that you didn't know who played Chris Beale?
Well, I thought it was actually Chris Bell, but that's because there's a typo in my notes.
But that doesn't matter, that's the character.
And then I remember I used to work with a Chris Bell.
Right, but that's the character's name, not Robert Popper's name.
Stop trying to dead cat us with anecdotes. You're just getting things wrong.
Just to clarify, you didn't know who played him, even though you've received a personalised video message from the actor that plays Chris Beale, aka Robert Popper.
He hasn't messaged me in a while. It's been a while.
Or have a quick look on IMDb.
Well, yeah, but I couldn't see anything.
You said
Chris
you'd look
Bell.
On IMDb. Also, you haven't done that.
You said he hasn't contacted you in a while. Are we to surmise from this that for you to recognise anyone's face, you expect like a weekly video message from us?
Check in weekly.
Is that the only reason you know who we are?
Yeah, so I can just keep abreast of changes to people.
Okay, anyway, Tom, let's delve more into Robert Popper. Let's get back to that.
Yeah, so as well as the shows that I just mentioned that he created, he also worked on the scripts for The IT Crowd, The Inbetweeners, Him and Her, and Peep Show as well. So a bit of a comic legend in terms of behind the scenes.
Also three episodes of Statler's Flats, I believe.
As oh, well yes, as,
of
that's
course,
really good.
The Around You, which you mentioned, and the Peter Serafinovich show as well.
Easy for you to say. I think part of the reason that this goes on to the point I'm about to make. The part of the reason that Nick was like, who is this guy? Mm. He's a bit rubbish, is that he plays the part.
Whoa.
Well, that is what you said.
That's English for stop a horse.
I'm just saying, I didn't think that, I thought that the chemistry wasn't as strong as it could have been.
But that's the point. That's the joke.
That's the gag. But I think that works because he is absolutely brilliant in this role. He nails it. It's like you totally believe him as a kind of rubbish local presenter who doesn't really have much presenting experience.
And I think it's a really strong Gibbons writing trait about really nailing the awkwardness of like these televised scenarios. And I think, I'm sure we'll draw up more examples, but I think you can see how a lot of this sort of stuff draws into this time as well, how they've used the awkward scenario of the TV studio.
I think it's not even just unique to the Gibbons writing as well. I think when we come on to talk about Knowing Me, Knowing You, I think there is a lot more texture to the guests in Open Books and Knowing Me, Knowing You radio, especially here where it's not just a case of, oh, okay, the host is us, the audience, and Alan is the fool. There's a bit of foolishness on both sides. And the way the turns of phrase and the puns from Chris in this that no one in the studio audience appreciates gives you a bit of an idea that he's, you know, he thinks he's a little bit better than he is. He thinks he's very learned and kind of literary. But actually, if Alan's a little bit too far down the ignorant route, Chris is a little too far up the pretentious route. And so they're kind of both at fault all the way through this.
Can I just say, the more we talk about this show, the more I like it already.
Well,
it kind of reveals itself a bit more when you start to dwell on it. Do you know what I mean?
Not to skip ahead too much, but I really like this. I think it's really good.
Well, because I think actually, and it's maybe not a bad thing to discuss at the opening, it's kind of, I was almost kind of dreading covering this because I watched it like originally kind of ran it when it came out, and I remember being quite underwhelmed by it. But so I think it's that thing, it's better on repeat viewings because you get to appreciate why the awkwardness is there and how it's supposed to work and how it all kind of gels together and I guess how it fits with other things in the APU around it as well.
I also like that I do probably offer a slight counter perspective that I didn't like it as much, but I take your points on board in terms of maybe it is a bit more layered than I've given it credit for, but let's also not forget it is ultimately a bit of a clumsy advert for a book.
That's true. Yeah.
Well, it is also that.
I think I dismissed it when it first came out as, oh, okay, this is basically just bits from the book. I think it is more than that, but also it's not a show in its own right, is it? It really wouldn't exist without the book and vice versa.
Yeah.
One thing I liked early on is that Chris Beale introduces Alan as, and I quote, a broadcasting colossus. And I think that's because partly Alan wants to be introduced that way, but also Chris would like to think that that's the level of guest that he's got as well. It sort of serves them both to pretend that he's a big deal.
I'm just quite enjoying that you're just hating on Chris the entire time. What a prick.
Is the first really awkward line with him when he says, out of the radio station and onto our bookshelves, not literally, I hope, and then cut to absolute silence from the studio audience.
There's a lot of like awkward silence throughout. The audience doesn't really give the participation that they need to at any stage.
No.
And is passive for the entire time.
It's kind of that glorious thing where it's the whole studio is just full of weirdos.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. As is often the case, I think, the smaller... Yeah. I mean, I think you get to these days in TV, you get to the point where if a show is that small, you would just do away with the audience entirely.
Yeah, it would be better without it.
Yeah, like a Lonely Connect or something like that. But this is obviously an even smaller show, only going out probably in the Anglia area, but they've insisted on bringing in an audience. So it's literally, the joke there is they've got to take what
they can
get.
I would say there is something about Only Connect that feels a bit cold and dead inside because there is no studio audience, actually. So I think... It's it's kind of...
I think they almost do it deliberately. That awkwardness is kind of... That's what Only Connect they're is having about, a laugh. The slight nerdy awkwardness of it.
Yeah. And I think it's probably worth mentioning, there was an Only Connect Alan Partridge round recently that quite a lot of people have messaged us about. So just, yes, we're aware of it. Thanks very much.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thank you much. Can we talk about maintaining a healthy anus, perhaps?
Sure.
I just really enjoyed that when they have the various clips of Alan throughout his career, that's the audible bit of speech in that clip from the Mid-Morning Masters era. Brilliant.
I also enjoyed him being championed as a champion of women in sport and then seen smacking a woman around the head in a helmet.
Brilliant.
Poor Rebecca Front.
Yeah.
So before we crack into the interview, I've got one more thing about Robert Popper, a bit of a large question. Is this his biggest acting role? Looking at IMDb, I think it might be, because the other key credits I pulled out were Annoying Man in an episode of Peep Show, Bookshop Customer in an episode of Spaced, Not Janine in Hot Fuzz, and uncredited news reporter voice in Shaun of the Dead.
Yes, I think it
so this is his starring role, isn't
very
it?
Much a genius behind the camera with occasional flashes of brilliance in front of it.
But I wonder also, like, what made him do this then? He clearly hasn't done any of these roles. Yeah. I wonder what it was that persuaded him to do it and why he hasn't subsequently done anything more.
But it's maybe that thing, just knowing that it's a one-off. It's a one-off show and it's an opportunity to be a part of the APU. I think like most comic actors would jump at that chance to be a part of it. Like, you know, I think we've all seen enough interviews about Tim Key saying how Steve Coogan was an absolute icon and he was kind of thrilled to be a part of the Partridge universe. So I'd imagine if you're someone who's a bit more inclined to be a writer and a bit more behind the scenes, but you can still be a part of it by doing one episode, why wouldn't you?
Yeah. Into the interview, so he suggests immediately that Alan Partridge and literature don't sit together in the mind's eye, but Alan corrects him, saying that he believes that they do in the brain's ear. I do quite like the bits peppered throughout this where Alan sort of thinks he's rising to meet the intellect of the interviewer and isn't. He's just saying words.
I guess they're both people where they, kind of like you were saying, they both think they're operating on a higher level of intellect, but they're both getting it wrong in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and he also tries to prove his point by saying he touched deeply by an English teacher at school and found that very exciting. But also, as a result, he got straight A's. So
But is that bollocks?
Well,
because he's trying to elevate himself again, isn't he? There's no evidence of him getting straight A's. He's got two shiny A levels.
You can pick your punchline, can't you? Either it's bollocks or something more sinister has happened to him at school and he's just sort of glossing over it there.
Well, if I Partridge is to be believed, he'd failed at failing his A-levels. That much we do know. I enjoyed the way the interview opened with Alan back to the camera on the phone saying you should ask people if they want ice. I assume he's on the phone to Lynn at that point.
Yeah.
And is this, I can't remember exactly, but I think this might be to do with he has been given a glass with ice by a runner, I think. So he's probably on the phone to Lynn complaining about the treatment he's had in the studio because he's been given ice without asking.
Yeah. And then you can, when he picks up the glass later on in the scene, you can hear the ice rattle. So I can assume he's annoyed about that. And I think, to be fair, from a television production point of view, you wouldn't want a, a glass of drink making noise whilst a guest is drinking from it.
Oh, I see. My interpretation of that was that he was organising like some kind of party or something like that. who would go to an Alan Partridge party? But then also that makes sense as well. You should ask people if they want ice, not just give it to them. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I think it could be that, but I think because you have the payoff of hearing.
I didn't spot that. That's good.
It's worth mentioning that as well as him reading large sections of I, Partridge out as part of this, so at least a third of this programme is basically the book. There are a few bits as well where he's talking about changing Fresh Pop Sounds to Cream of Our Discharge as an example of him sort of being good with words. So, I mean, that's a joke we've heard elsewhere. Mm. Well,
I double-checked. That section is word for word becomes a footnote in Nomad.
Mm. Right, okay, yeah. Oh, I see. So this is the first time you hear that, but it's recycled
later. Yeah. So exactly that whole phrase about Saxon Radio in Bury St. Edmunds. Yeah, word for word.
Did anyone else check IMDb for any actors in this and note some Partridge alumni in the audience?
No, I didn't actually.
We have Martin Glynn Murray, who is one of the members of the book club, who has played various callers in Mid-Morning Matters and This Time, and is if you read Steve Coogan's autobiography, is a sort of long-term friend and collaborator as well.
Oh, great. I love how nervous and disgruntled the book club look as well.
Yeah.
You can tell by looking at them that it's not gone down well.
Yeah.
And Alan seems very suspicious of them, even when they're claiming to enjoy it.
I liked... when they asked them, did you like it? And it's simply, yes.
Yes.
Just a one-word response. Yeah. Yep.
Their performance throughout is nothing short of enigmatic. They add so much to the show.
But I mean, they're all uneasy in front of the camera. Chris Beale is uneasy in front of the camera. Alan is uneasy being with members of the general public. It's all just unease upon unease upon unease.
He also becomes visibly nervous when he's asked to prove that he's a book enthusiast. Because he knows he's in uncharted waters. I've written, he feels challenged and he's angry.
Yes, I'm a bibliophile.
And also he's gone to the effort of dressing as a writer, or at least what he thinks a writer should dress like. So the shirt and the cravat and everything.
Of course
I'm a writer. I'm dressed like one. It's fine.
The things he thinks he knows about books are the five things that people that don't know about books know about books. Like, for example, that people have burned books. So he's like, oh, I wouldn't burn a book. I only burned one. Does anyone know the book he burned and why?
Oh, it's the Quran. Not the Quran, it's the Kama Sutra.
It's the Kama Sutra. And do you know why he burned it?
Oh, I can't remember now.
Because he felt the women in it were too slutty. I think what he's done there is he thinks that it's the same woman in every position and that they've gone too far.
He's very much quantifying his book knowledge as well, isn't he? Because he kind of says, oh, he's got over 100 books in the same way that he says, I've got over 100 friends. Yep. That number is like a sweet spot that kind of triggers some kind of status of him being a well-read individual.
104 books.
Also, we don't actually believe that he's well-read at all, do we? I mean, we've asked previously on a podcast if Alan's ever finished a book.
Bravo to Zero, I think was the conclusive answer.
Yeah. Well, yes.
And it improves with every read.
That we forgot.
And I think
let's not dwell on our mistakes.
I think you can read a lot into him now grasping for straws, talking about how he reads short recipes on the loo to plan what's going to be the cause of his next visit.
Oh, yeah.
That's so
apparently
good.
Now recipes qualify when you're trying to prove your literary credentials.
Yep. I enjoyed that he called Christmas Crispmas as well.
There are a couple of great details I love about obviously, the joke being how deliberately bad the TV production is, very, very poorly done. Like, Alan has to walk across the shot to go and read the book. So it's all about mocking poor production values of local TV. A proper TV show, you'd probably pre-record those segments entirely separately, or you just edit out the fact he has to walk across the back of the shot.
Well, in fact, throughout the show, you see him walk over to read the book, but then when
he never walk back.
When he goes back to the interview, they do cut that. So they could have cut it. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess it's all part of the layers of the joke. And also, did you notice when he goes to sit down for the first reading, he says, where's the book? It should be there. So again, stuff you could edit out, but obviously that is the joke.
I also enjoyed, you'd have kind of quite awkward shots of the audience just like nodding along. interesting.
They all actually just end up looking like they wish they weren't there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Alan then says that he bought Richard Hammond's autobiography as a favour to him at a car boot sale. The quote is, came out of a boot of a car, much like he did at high speed.
You know, I hadn't really thought about that. That's quite bad.
That is quite bad. I went onto Amazon and looked up Richard Hammond's autobiography. Join me as I read one of the Amazon one-star reviews. Okay.
Is this our new regular feature?
A new regular feature, one-star reviews. This is a strange product that I borrowed off Matt, who found it in a bin near Asda. Great start.
I toyed with the idea of reading it for several seconds before reminding myself that Hammond is awful at everything that he does or says. Given that everything Hammond has ever done is dire and below the threshold which would be classed as lowest common denominator entertainment for morons, and I mean utter morons who are not academically capable of understanding an episode of Judge Judy, I still was in two minds. I mean, there is a moral dilemma here. What do I do with the book? If I bin it, as the previous owners did, then there is a risk that it may be discovered and contaminate somebody else's mind. A child, or simpleton, for instance. If I destroy it, then I might be accused of being a Hitlerite for burning a book, albeit a dreadful, pointless, and pathetically rubbish one. Does anyone know of a nearby volcano so that I can throw it in there to be on the safe side?
Ouch. Lovely. There's a section around this point where he's talking about, he implies that he holidays alone in the car, a boot full of luggage, as many books as he can fit on the back seat and passenger seat. It becomes obvious that this is an invented holiday, and it's one of those things, again, that even in the holiday that he's conjured up in his mind, he's still travelling alone. There's no room in that car for any company.
That's classic, isn't it? His imagination always fails him, doesn't it?
Mm. They ask him if he prefers paper or an electronic device, and you get a nice little bit of Alan cadence that I like, where he goes, oh, paper. Old paper, like very sort of wistful about it, yeah.
And it's slightly clutching at straws, but almost a throw forward to paper, paper, paper.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think just before that happens, there's a bit where he makes Chris do a really high-pitched meow sound, and that bit just really, really tickled me. I enjoyed that a lot.
Chris, at that point, has got a bit of a slight Psychic Simon feel to him, I thought.
Is it the beard?
It's the beard. it's the way that Alan basically forces him to make a bit of a fool of himself. And then Chris gets on to talking about his own book about the Crimean War, but Alan's got no patience for it, a bit like when Psychic Simon's telling the tale of being adopted and Alan just cuts him off mid-flow.
Yeah, that's a good shout. Because Alan says, he admits to Chris's face that he hasn't read Chris's book because he hates the title.
Terrible title.
It's a valid reason, isn't it? I'm not going to read it.
He also mentions, Alan does, that the benefit of a real book to him over an electronic device is that it doesn't allow him to access pornography on it like a tablet would. I think he basically can't resist the lure. And I mean, this is a theme that's explored again in Alpha Papa, isn't it?
Yeah.
Does he say, it's enjoy a good novel free from the nagging distraction of hardcore online pornography? What a line.
I think we can all relate to that.
Did anyone else notice that when he was actually reading the chapters from iPartridge, that at no point was he actually reading the book itself? He was just reading from an auto cue.
Yes, but also, if you actually look at the book in his hands, I think some things were highlighted.
Yeah.
Oh, do you think?
You can see them.
Oh, right, okay.
I'm not guessing. You literally say it.
We find out that he thinks Mr. Tickle is a Dickens character.
Dickens.
And did anyone make note of the poetic way that he thought about the pulping of Bouncing Back? He says, I don't think of it as gone. If you pulp some biscuits, you haven't lost those biscuits. You've gained the base of a cheesecake. and he says, and a tenner for 80,000 words. Partridge is no slouch in the value for money department either. So again, books are judged by their weight rather than their content in Alan's world.
Actually, that's an interesting link to Know Me, Knowing You Radio, about books and their weight.
Yeah,
we'll get to that.
We'll cover it.
I think we're at the point where he spots some twins in the audience, aren't we?
Did anyone spot these first time? You know, when they cut to the first guy, did anyone else notice the person in the back?
No, I didn't either.
Not the first viewing, but obviously when review it, you're like, yeah.
But when they cut to him for the first time, the twin is in the background. Didn't notice at all.
Yeah.
Looks a lot like Elijah Wood as well. A pointless fact there.
I mean,
also fact, dubious definition.
Yeah, right, fair enough.
It marks the first of many occasions throughout the rest of this show where Alan has people moving and replacing audience members at will.
I don't even know if he's having that. Is he having influence on that, or is it being done?
Well, I think it's being done to appease him, whether he's actually asked for it or not,
because he's found the twins off-putting when they're next to each other.
Yeah. He doesn't communicate. Yeah, I suppose they just take...
And then you see that they've been moved apart. Yeah. And then we'll get onto it, but there's another person that becomes an issue for Alan.
Okay, can you guys remember when Alan's asked how he'd write his own book, he uses three words. What were those words?
Is one of them timeless? No?
No.
I know they're all very complimentary, obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
So what we're learning is no one's got this in their notes.
No.
Describing the same book, he says it left him astonished, elated and humbled.
Did it leave you guys astonished, elated and humbled when you read it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Couldn't agree more.
Probably elated is the most likely of those three.
Did you like the detail about, he talks about his mother reading to him for half an hour every night before hitting the stopwatch? Yeah. Like, that's something I definitely didn't pick up on first
viewing. I hadn't noticed that. Brilliant.
He also does mention his father being dead in this in this version of the APU. So that's what we're going with.
Yeah, I enjoyed that on his mum reading to him. The detail that she would, for some inexplicable reason, Germanize Rupert and Paddington, but did a brilliant noddy.
Yep, outstanding noddy.
Also, I think one part that we missed earlier, which I found was quite an interesting line, was that Alan said that it was reinventing the autobiography genre for the Skype generation. Like, the Skype generation? When was that a thing?
That is not a thing, is it? That is really good, actually. I hadn't really picked up on that.
That feels like something where a lazier comedy writer would have used MySpace, but Skype is just a slightly more current and not such an obvious, dated term to use. I also like that he nearly called the book knee-jerk, but was worried that to Geordies it would sound like saying there's near jokes in it.
That is good.
And there is jokes in it.
I also enjoyed Alan referring to his dad as Pop, which he has done before, but that his dad would secretly read The Secret Seven hidden in the dust jacket of the book of the fall of the Roman Empire. Like, that his dad's so ashamed of reading Enid Blyton.
Oh, but I think the payoff to this is brilliant when he's basically saying, oh yeah, my father had a secret love of looking at books about children. And then there's a look of realisation on his face that this might be quite dark. That is so good.
There's then a list of things that he had to take out of his book. All bleeped out. I don't know if anyone else has got a list, but Martin Bashir's bleep addiction, the incredible sweat problems faced by bleep. There's a whole Toxvig saga, bleep's addiction to fascism, and the time Alastair Stewart found a bleep. Two chicks with dicks.
Yeah. I love that bit's not bleeped out. Oh, yeah, and then but the next note I have is about big aims in a bad place.
Also the fact that he's been calling Sally Gunnell from a payphone. No context for that, really, but just, I thought it was important.
Yeah, you know, and the reason that big aim, well, not what the reason that big aims is in a bad place, but the reason that line comes is because Eamon Holmes has been sending Alan a JPEG of a mutilated squirrel.
Oh, that's right.
And Chris has also received that image.
No, because I think it's that sort of thing, it's a bit like when he talks about being on an email distribution list with, who was it? Richard Keys.
Yes.
It's a bit like, so Alan's kind of in circles like Richard Keys, Eamon Holmes. I don't believe Chris Beale would be in those circles, however.
No. Love you, Aim.
I do also enjoy that this, it's, again, just adding to the layers of the textuality here, that even though this standalone show may not be the best addition to the APU, which I'm sure we can summarise at the end, but you know, the fact it does add on like more to the mythology about his friendship with Sally Gunnell, with Eamon Holmes, stuff like that, it just makes it all that little bit richer.
They like to top up the kind of the stories of his friendship. Yeah.
It must be nice as well if you're Eamon Holmes and you're a genuine fan, or Noel Edmonds, you never know, they might enjoy the show, and them kind of like receiving this or hearing about their own persona portrayed in the APU. I can't believe that Eamon Holmes would not be a fan of that.
Eamon, if you're listening, get in touch, mate.
Let us know. What's it like?
When we see famous people who are mentioned in the APU respond to it, it is a mixed bag, isn't it? I think Bill Oddie's
confused by it more than anything, I think.
Yeah,
but Eamon Holmes is so over the top, like him in the bath eating sliders, him sending Alan a mutilated squirrel, like it's quite extreme.
I like to think that Eamon Holmes' reaction to this would be, more about me, sure, great, love it. So we get questions from audience members or statements. One of them says that Alan's book made them cry, to which Alan says he's in a delighted place to hear that.
Just before that, I think there's a lot to dwell on here. Just before that, another bad production value. I think as Alan's going over to read the section splitting from Carol, the studio lights actually dip on Chris Beale as he's setting up that segment. So again, like, if that happened in a real TV show record, you'd do it again. Mm.
I also liked that Carol receives, and I quote, a fair portrayal. I think we know that that's not true.
So yeah, that audience question is a bit weird, isn't it? I'm not sure this bit works massively for me.
Well, I think the main point to make, it's not even a question.
No, true.
It's just, so the actor is Tom Davis, and we'll talk about him in a minute. But yeah, just saying, I don't have a question, it just made me cry. The guy who bullied you at school, he was horrible, wasn't he? And Alan starts looking quite scared at this point.
Yeah,
it's confused. Yeah,
I think it's. I guess it's a little bit of, this is the sort of twilight zone, this show, of where celebrities and members of the public are not separated in the way that they would, that the celebrity would like to be entirely comfortable. This is like the opening of a supermarket kind of situation, isn't it? Where
the public could touch him if they wanted to.
Yeah, maniacs that might have spent a lot of their time thinking about you while you spent none of your time thinking about them can turn up and freely stand right in front of you and say whatever they want.
I feel like the implication here is this is almost Jed Maxwell part two, isn't it? This guy is a little bit too emotionally attached.
Especially when he comes back around around for another question. And then you notice in the next shot that he's been replaced by a runner. They don't have any spare audience, so it's just someone with a headset.
So I think when we were talking about, is that at Alan's request, I think obviously this studio production team, they've gone, right, get this guy out of here. This is going to go bad.
Yep. And then next thing you know, the twins have been moved again as well. So that's three times now the audience has had to be shifted.
And are you guys familiar with Tom Davis at all? Any of his work?
I looked at his IMDb. I think the only thing that I'd seen him in was in Paddington 2, which is brilliant.
Yeah. So I think probably the vehicle he's most known for is probably Murder in Successville. But I have to say in my notes, I've near seen it.
No, I haven't seen that either. Although it was reviewed very, very well, wasn't it?
It's supposed to be good. really good, so probably should give that a watch.
He's also on Judge Ramesh. Anyone watch that?
Oh, I've seen an episode of it. Yeah. I didn't see him.
He's the bailiff in Judge Ramesh.
Right. And King Gary, which is quite a recent BBC thing as well, which I think Ramesh also is a character in. I think key mention, I think Jed will enjoy this. He was also horrifically murdered in Prevenge.
Nice. Great film.
Yeah. One more fact. He's apparently 6'7" tall.
Yeah, he looks like a big lad, doesn't he?
That is a tall man.
That is a big unit.
Can anyone tell me how Alan conjures up a feeling of anger when writing?
Is this about the bag of Skittles?
Yes, he eats an entire bag of Skittles and that makes him angry enough to write. I suppose he doesn't need to recapture the anger of his youth, doesn't he? Because a lot of his chapters are basically grudges.
I think that this sort of ties into what we're going to come and talk about a little bit later in future episodes around obviously the radio series, but violence is a sort of red thread that runs through all of that. But I did enjoy that, and his whole writing style in general, in terms of him doing 1,500 words a day, which is obviously a fairly paltry sum. The fact that he needs to take a break every couple of hours to do shadow boxing, just the image that kind of conjures, that he's gone, oh, I've done, 500 words, time for a quick shadow box. Just let off a bit of steam.
I mean, also the fact that he keeps boiled eggs in a bowl in a drawer.
For sustenance.
Yeah, I mean, that suggests that he bulk boils and then they sit in that drawer for God knows how long so that he can just eat them quickly when he needs a pick-me-up.
Seriously, it stinks.
Could we assume that he's sharing those eggs with Seldom?
Yes. Yes, possibly. Maybe that's why they have to go in a drawer that he can close to keep Seldom away.
Jed, I assume that would be your snack of choice whilst writing. Yeah, two thumbs up.
Ed is... Ed?
Ed? Who's Ed?
It's a mixture of Jed and Egg.
Producer Ed.
Egg Shepherd. And that's not a man shepherding eggs.
No,
that's a man called Egg Shepherd.
Yes, and also coincidentally, Jed's dream job.
Just to go back to the Skittles, I like the fact that he eats the bag. After a brief sugar rush, he then falls asleep on the tracker pad and then has to be woken up by Lynn.
Also, they mentioned that off the back of the boiled eggs, he once didn't poo for 4 days and his cleaner said he went yellow. Presumably at this point, Sonia is still that cleaner, we think.
That poo story is brilliant. So he gets his fibre intake wrong, doesn't poo for 4 days, drinks 2 pints of milk of magnesia.
Have you got the quote?
I haven't got the quote here, but I've basically got it was lucky that he was out in a forest. He went in the forest, he burned his clothes and waited until nightfall and then ran home.
Yep.
In a forest by a river.
To give a direct quote, Chris says, did that work? Oh yeah. Christ, yeah. Be careful what you wish for. Thank God I was in a forest by a river. I just burned my clothes and then ran home.
And that's another thing that I've really picked up on in a few rewatches of this, that there are these throwaway kind of details, like he was in a forest by a river, where you get these little snapshots of whatever Alan's daily life is. And I think those are the real gems in this show, I think. That, like his writing process with his Skittles and the boiled eggs, it's just those ridiculous things that come out, but they're kind of throwaway in the actual core narrative of what the show's all about.
See, interestingly, reading that back and talking about it now, if that was to happen in, say, if that poo story was to happen in, say, Alpha Papa or in another sitcom with Alan in it, you would think that was jumping the shark. It was too ridiculous. But just him talking about it is really, really funny. But if it happened in a show, you'd be a bit like, well, that's not Alan, really. That's not Alan comedy, really. Yeah.
They're very good at not putting it in front of you, but just letting you know it's happening.
Yeah,
they can get away with the more extreme stuff by it has to exist in your mind's eye or your mind's ear.
I like to think
brain's ear.
In the in the Alan archivist file, wherever that exists, we know it's somewhere, that there's just a long list of bullet points about Alan's personality, just in case you need them. And that one of them says, claims Andy McNab invented the present tense for dramatic effect. Because they talk a lot about Alan switching tenses in a very kind of crude and obvious way in this book. And he basically claims that it's Andy McNab that invented the idea in the first place.
Yeah, Alan's writing style is described by one of the book club members as schizophrenic. And Alan immediately has issue with that and says he wants to stab the audience member.
Oh, yeah.
I take that back.
They say he lurches between styles of tone and sentimentality. And then he accuses Chris. Is it Chris? The presenter and the book club reviewer says, you sound like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, which is obviously a bastardization of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern,
I was still
quite impressed, because even though I think he does mispronounce the second name, it's quite a strut for him. That's quite a good literary reference.
Yeah, to get it half
two
right.
Parts from Hamlet
is not bad. Did anyone note down Alan's four reasons that he cries?
Yep.
He only cries for four reasons.
Yep. Sadness.
Yes.
Onions.
Yes.
Racism.
Yes.
Not blinking.
Yep.
But mainly sadness and onions.
Yep. Sorry, racism, it's a no. He usually remembers to blink and he avoids racism where he can. I also like that in the, I think it's Chris says it to him, he says, the title I, Partridge has been called needlessly grandiose, to which Alan says, thank you very much.
That's quite a good trope that I think you see more, that people paying him, well, basically people criticising him and he misreads it as a compliment.
Yeah.
I think even going back to the original radio series, there are a few times when that happens.
Yep.
I think interestingly, I've got more notes on Open Books in the latter half. So I think by this point, the pace has picked up a little bit and the gags are coming quite quickly here, I think.
Now, I like Alan's written output. I imagine I would enjoy Bouncing Back if I got the chance to read it.
I'd love them to make Bouncing Back.
I enjoyed I, Partridge and I enjoyed Nomad, but I feel like the book I really want to read is Alan's What If Titanic book that he talks about at this point, where he's sort of written in his mind, but definitely not on the page, where Titanic has a double hull and fewer passengers. The driver ends up being charged with speeding and the driver dreams the whole disaster as a premonition, sort of Final Destination style.
I love that the whole thing just doesn't make any sense. The more he has to explain it, the more it falls apart.
I also, this is a bit of a stretch, but I think this special was around the time that Steve Coogan had done quite a stint of going to Hollywood and appearing in comedies and things. And I suppose this kind of bastardizing the Titanic story is not a million miles away from Steve Coogan's role in Hamlet 2, which is a film I'd love to see and I still haven't seen.
I
can't remember the plot off the top of my head, but I think it's basically about, you know, attempting to top the original tale. Yeah,
Hamlet 2 this time, it's Hamlet-ier.
Exactly. So I mean, this is definitely along those lines, and you know, perhaps that's where the genesis for this What If Titanic book came from, the similar kind of thing.
Did anybody make a note of who Alan would want to play him in a film on the Hollywood subject?
Yep, I've got that.
Yeah, me too.
You go, Nick.
Okay, I'll go, Tom. Thanks.
You go.
Damian Lewis.
Well done, Nick.
The ginger actor.
The ginger actor, Damian Jack-ter. Lewis. I would say a question for the group. Who would you have play you in a film?
Ooh.
Tom, you do Adam. Adam, you do me. Me, I'll do Stab.
You've lost me there.
Right, okay.
Who would you have play you in a film? You're
but
doing
I don't
Adam.
Get to choose
Adam,
me.
You're
I get to choose who plays Adam.
You're asking us who do we want to play us in a film, but we're not allowed
doing
to
it
answer
for
the
other
question.
People.
Yes.
Okay.
Right,
who am I doing?
Adam, you're getting John Goodman.
Okay. That's fair. I'm going to give Nick a young David Jason.
I'm going to give Tom Stab a...
Just say Brad Pitt.
I'm going to say...
You remind me of a young Lenny Henry.
Yeah. Maybe a shorter Stephen Merchant.
All right.
Fine. And who am I doing?
The only one left.
Dark. Will from the Inbetweeners. Simon Bird.
Really great.
Fair. So for this last segment, Alan has stood on his glasses, so he's now...
that is brilliant.
But don't. What I love is, it kind of, again, it's one of those gags that they've done that sort of unfurls in a few stages. First, he stands on his glasses, which is kind of funny. Then he has massive replacement glasses on, and then they cut to the audience member that he's taken them from, who's desperately squinting.
I didn't spot that.
Oh, it's yeah, I love it.
I didn't spot that.
It's really a really good 1-2-3, isn't it?
I think I was distracted by the fact that his glasses have gone full Deirdre Rasheed.
Yeah.
And this is the bit where sexuality and sensuality come up a lot, don't they? Repeated endlessly.
Actually, there's a line about Prince Charles, but I couldn't place where he's talked about Prince Charles in the past. I can't remember there a reference in I, Partridge. I can't remember, but what I do like is Alan's quote afterwards, which is, I fully support his views on architecture, whatever they may be.
I think that's just where the gag lies, isn't it? That he's saying that he agrees with something, but he doesn't actually know what he's agreeing with.
And ultimately just wants to be friends with anyone who's rich enough to own their own manor.
Yes. So Adam, would you say that this podcast is sexual and sensual?
I would certainly consider this podcast sensual and sexual, but I'm not sure that I can conclusively say that it was sensual and sexual.
I would say it wasn't sexual, but was it sensual?
Alan is unsure whether his evening with Glenn Ponder was sensual or not.
Yeah. Well, he's very clear that it's not sexual, isn't he?
Like, yeah.
He knows,
it wasn't sexual.
He knows he doesn't want that to be true. But the more he thinks about it, you can see he's coming around to the idea that either it might have been sensual, or probably more likely that saying it was might ingratiate him to a literary crowd.
I did enjoy the slow zoom as well as that question is posed.
Yes. The long, awkward pause.
The slow zoom while Alan, like, genuinely digs into his mind to think about what the answer to this question might be.
There's an absolutely wonderful couple of sentences where he's talking about dating when you're older.
Yep.
He says, when you're over 50, you have to accept a degree of humiliation. It's a numbers game. If you run into a chicken coop with a truncheon and a bin bag, you're not going to get them all.
That is great writing.
I think that's my highlight of the episode, personally.
Line of the episode, I think. Also, this is not a big deal, but just something odd that I think they must have thrown in for comic effect. Alan pours himself a fresh glass of water when he knows there's 30 seconds left of the show.
So the thing about dating is, what we learn here is that Alan has been making a habit of approaching women in petrol station forecourts.
Yeah,
right?
Does that work?
So, well, maybe mixed results. But again, that's one of those little throwaway, it's almost a throwaway detail, but it's a real insight into what Alan's life is like at this point. Mm. And I also just enjoyed keeping it centred around the petrol station. So, you know, Michael's not there, but he's still going to whatever his local BP garage is, but now he's doing that to pick up women instead.
But I'd also say, like, it isn't desperation, but it is for Alan, because I feel like he probably doesn't put any time, effort or energy into dating. It's just a case of, like, anything will do, and it's an absolute mad dash, whatever he can get.
Anyone's around.
Yeah. A ram raid.
Also, just think about the logistics, the realistic logistics of him trying to date people that he meets in a garage. I mean, firstly, garages are tiny. If I went into a petrol station garage and was there for more than 5 minutes, I would feel very uncomfortable, especially if there's this one person behind the counter looking at me. Like, it's not the sort of place you can just while away the hours waiting for women to come in that you find attractive, is it?
I wonder if he's based this on Michael meeting Neris outside of Thrasher's. So if that worked for Michael, that could work for me.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, if it worked for Michael, it probably could work for him.
Exactly.
That seems fair.
I think there are a few things. Actually, I think when you're talking about the glass of water, like, why does he have another glass of water? I wonder if, basically, these last couple of moments of the show, I wonder if the whole Glenn Ponder conversation has just really thrown him, because when he says he gets asked if he'd like to read another section of the book, he just shakes his head. And then he's just, as the show closes, Alan's just looking uncomfortable, just like shrugging at Chris. And it read to me like maybe he's really stuck on the Glenn Ponder question now, and he just can't get that out of his mind.
I think it is that. I think also, this at this point, it's been a long time since he's been on telly, and I think he's either forgotten or he's got no respect for the conventions of TV. So that's why he's on his phone at the start of the episode. He pours himself a water when it makes no sense to do it. When Chris is trying to have sort of, you know, silent chat over the credits, as people do, Alan refuses to take part in it.
Yeah.
And it's either that it's been so long since Knowing Me, Knowing You, that he just doesn't know what he's doing, or he's just, you know, he's been on a big BBC TV show, now he's on a little Norfolk show, why should he bother trying?
I think it would make sense that he believes he's better than that show. He's probably doing it because it's all he can get.
So how do we think this fits into the ranking of Alan projects? It's hard because obviously it's part I, Partridge, but...
And it's part promotional.
Yes.
Well, actually, I've done some number crunching on this, because this is the thing about saying I was a bit reticent about covering it, like, oh, it's just a rehashing of I, Partridge material. But actually, there are 12 minutes and 28 seconds of reading from the book, and the show in total is 42 minutes, 33 seconds. So it's 29% of the show is I, Partridge material.
So it's basically a half-hour special.
We've got a half hour of new Alan in this show. Mm-hmm. So it is, when you think about it like that, it's like, actually... Yeah, it's not bad. There is more value to it than just a rehash of him reading out words from my Partridge.
Because if it was, I mean, obviously it is, like Nick said, you know, a bit of a piece of promo for the book. It would have been a lot easier for them to just do a straight sort of more promotional led episode rather than bothering to write a whole bunch of new material. But they've gone to the effort of building this conceit. They've gone to the effort of, like you said, doing basically half an hour's worth of new Alan material in order to, you know, get the Alan reading quotes from it. And, you know, I don't see it as, even though ultimately it probably is a vehicle to sell the book, I don't view it as a cynical cash in, just quick turnaround.
Yeah, I think they brought value to it.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think it really works when you contextualise that this aired on TV just after the paperback coming out, and it was also a prelude to the Mid-Morning Matters series going on Sky Atlantic as well. It's actually like, it really works well sitting between the two, and it's a way that if people weren't aware of the book or were dubious about the book, it's a good way for Partridge fans to learn, actually, this book is great and you should get it. So
I think it's one thing that I didn't appreciate at the time when all this was going on, probably, and didn't give the writers enough credit for, is that they don't take shortcuts, really. You know, like, if you think about iPartridge coming out, they would have had so many opportunities to do the shit cash-in, you know, word search, like, caption competition version of an Alan Partridge book for Christmas, and they didn't.
Yeah.
And with this, we know he did a book tour of Waterstones around the release of this, because there's a little snippet of footage in this. They could easily have just cobbled together a clip show from that with some of Alan's best bits.
That's a good point. It could have just been a clip show.
Yeah. But they didn't. They made a half-hour special, and it went out, and it shows, you know, the quality shows, I think.
Did we cover this at the beginning? It went out on Sky, didn't it?
Yeah,
Sky Atlantic.
I mean, you know what? I think it's hard to know where to place this, because I would say it's not as good as the other specials. Like, it's not as good as Places of My Life, I don't think it's as good as Scissored Isle, but also it is a bit of a different proposition because it exists for slightly different reasons.
And it's a bit more similar to Mid-Morning Matters, I think, in that it exists in real time and in the constraints of a very limited, you know, it's one room, it's only the people there, it's not even as much behind the scenes as there is in this time. So I think I quite like, I prefer the Alan that comes out when it's in quite tight parameters like that. I really enjoyed it.
I think what was really interesting for me watching it again recently was watching it post this time existing. You can really see how they've taken, where they've played around with the formats of the awkwardness of live television and the television studio. You can see how they've taken, they started playing around with those ideas in Open Books, and they've then taken them through to this time and made them work in a bigger and better way. So I think the hindsight of that makes it a much more rewarding watch in a way.
And I think you probably got the sort of tropes of their writing style that you can now see with the joy of hindsight, that probably when it came out, you were still kind of adjusting to some degree to getting used to what was the next phase of Alan. But on reflection now, you can kind of see it and you recognise it in terms of it has the sort of Gibbons all over it, if you will.
Any further thoughts on Open Books?
It's also worth pointing out, maybe, or considering that this isn't particularly well viewed by a majority of the Partridge audience or to our listeners at home.
Is that the curse of Sky Atlantic?
I think so, yeah. So it's probably just worth saying that if you do want to watch Open Books, if you haven't seen it yet, or if you want to watch it again, if you look hard enough, it is available on the internet. But then also you can buy it on DVD. There is a sort of special package that's available on DVD. It's called Alan Partridge, A Partrimilgrimage, the specials, and that includes Welcome to the Places of My Life and Open Books.
Great. Before we wrap up, I've got a bit of a fun game that I thought we could play before we finish the episode.
Nick's fun game. Fun game.
So Alan says that you can save time if the title explains the plot. So he gives an example where he says, church puzzle collection would be the Da Vinci Code. So what I've done is I've crafted what I hope is, really hope it works, 10 similar examples. All you have to do is guess the book based on the short description. Does everything make sense? Yell it out if you know.
Just fastest name first.
Okay.
Yell it out when you know, okay. And we'll see how we go. And let's, without further ado, let's start.
Play along at home.
Play along at home, number one. Clown goes berserk twice.
Tom.
I'm going to say Tom Dark.
It.
Correct. Thank you.
Always remember the bell. Yep. We did forget that in a previous episode, but we've got it now.
Number two. Superheroes turn out to not all be super.
Tom.
Yes, Tom.
Watchmen.
Correct. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Number three.
Have we thought about how many plots we're ruining for people who haven't read these books?
It's too late for that.
If you haven't read the books, look away now.
We saved it to the end for a reason.
Yeah. Number three. Local DJ goes for big walk.
Tom.
Adam.
It's Tom Stab.
Nomad.
No.
Also, I think the way Nick has done this, it is more of a plot reveal than like a kind of...
It's still a bit of fun. Number four,
easy for you to say.
Repressed millennials bonk.
Adam. 50 Shades of Grey.
Correct. Number five. Detective's holiday is ruined on a river cruise.
Tom Stab. It is Death on the Nile.
Yeah. Very good.
Number six. A messiah goes for a ride on a sandworm.
Tom Stab. Is it June?
Correct.
Yeah. It's a sandworm that gave it away, isn't it?
Number seven. Schoolgirl's cold adventure to sort parents' relationship.
Say that again.
What?
Schoolgirl's cold adventure to sort parents' relationship.
Adam. Is it His Dark Materials?
Very good.
Number eight. Aliens invade and catch a cold.
Tom Stab. Wild Woods.
Correct. Yeah, yes. War of the Worlds. Number nine. Evil genius solves and commits crimes.
Actually, quite annoying when you can't think of it.
Tom Stab.
Okay.
Confused with your own name. Yeah.
Mary Shelley's Frankenstein?
No.
Can we get it again?
Yep, get it again. Evil genius solves and commits crimes. Talk amongst yourselves.
I don't know.
Dead air is a crime.
I'm annoyed that Nick is stumping us.
I know. Okay. Silence of the Lambs. And this is a bit of a play on words. So number 10, count on this guy to suck.
Tom.
Ah,
Dracula. Or Dracula.
It must be Dracula. That concludes my fun game.
I think it definitely worked, Nick.
Yeah, great.
It really worked.
Nick, I have to say, it was brilliant that you had the idea to come up with that quiz.
Yeah, 100% your idea. Well
all
done,
Nick's
Nick.
Own work.
Well done, Nick.
Who won, by the way? I've got
a sticker or a lollipop for Nick.
Yeah.
Did you keep score?
I think Tom Stab won.
I think
Tom Stab's winning all the quizzes.
Well, I got three.
I got
Adam
more.
Adam got some, Tom got some.
There we go. And on that hotly contested literary bombshell, we come to the end of this week's Monkey Tennis. Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't subscribed, please do. It's the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. And if you haven't given us a review, we would appreciate anything. 5 stars or up. You can't get any higher. Get in touch with us as well. Let us know what you think about open books. Maybe you're watching it for the first time off the back of listening to this, or perhaps you are an advocate that's been very angry we've never covered it until now. It's thepartridgepod@gmail.com, facebook.com/thepartridgepod, on Twitter it's @thepartridgepod, Instagram @monkeytennispod, and the Monkey Tennis hotline is 07923 600 017. From all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge Fan Podcast, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Thank you.
Egg Shepherd.
I must complete the journey that my father never could. I must do it on foot. Can't remember why. It will be called The Footsteps of My Father Walk. My home isn't insulated.
I was going to say as well that I was going to do some Roald Dahl names, but then I thought his books are actually the best at giving the plot summary in the title. So George's Marvelous Medicine, you can't beat that, can you? James and the Giant Peach, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, The Twits.
Man Rides on Fruit.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's the same. You haven't shortened it.
No, that's true.
Yeah, you've just...
Please, this is like you at the live show again, apologising to the audience.
Nick's funny story.
Monkey Tennis?
Heathrow is just an absolute tit of an airport. Quite simply, cows.
Monkey Tennis?
With a stupid Ewok head.
Blah, 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 nosy.
Love you, Aim.
Monkey Tennis?
A total wazzock of a guy. Infinity, the final frontier.
Monkey Tennis?
We will talk about it now, Mr. Nichols.
Monkey Tennis?
Motherfucker.
Gary Wilmot, okay. Sue Cook, okay. Dale Winton, okay.
Monkey Tennis?
Oh, fuck off, Nick.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.